president of a consulting firm, Future Resources Associates, and was a senior officer on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff, first as deputy director and then as director of the Office of Nuclear Regulatory Research. His work has emphasized risk-informed regulation, probabilistic methods for safety analysis, and he has a specialty in analyzing seismic effects of nuclear installations. Bob received his PhD and MA degrees in experimental physics from Harvard and a bachelor's from Yale. And Frank is back, and we welcome your presentation. Please join me in welcoming back.
We love you, Frank. In fact, that's the subject of what I'm going to say first. Everybody who says something about how much they love Frank has a different take on the personality and of course, on his wife and kids and so on. You're having trouble hearing me. I've got to move it up. Is that better? But I have a different take, and I want to be sure to share it with you because this multifaceted personality has a very important facet to me and Frank that no one has mentioned yet. And that is, I know exactly why I'm here, and I'm going to try to explain the anecdote that they'll explain it. As soon as I saw him, I pulled him aside, and I told him about a joke I had just heard in Yiddish at the show last week. And there isn't anybody else in the room that could understand that. Okay, it's just, it's something we share together and that I learned the first time I ever met Frank, and he's laughing, which is correct, and which is a special piece of his life and mine that other people don't share, and you should know that. Besides everything else that this fellow is, he's a very strong, committed Jewish kid from Somerville, of which the J word is an important part of his personality, hasn't been mentioned before. It doesn't dominate his life, but it is an important piece of him, and it's an important piece of me, and it's a link I have with him that not anybody else does. In fact, I was thinking about starting with this joke. It consists of a Franciscan friar with a brown thing with a hood and the rope and the sandals, and just next to him is a Jewish chassid with his black and his long white beard and the payas and the tzitzit and all that stuff. And I was going to tell it, but then I realized that, first of all, it loses in translation, and second of all, I don't think it would be all that appropriate, but Frank laughed about it.
I laugh at everything he says.
And I laugh at everything you say.
Is that number 37?
It was a new one, but I have to say Apkowitz in the back would maybe understand this too, although I don't know about Mark whether your Yiddish is up to mine. But and of course, my Barbara loves him too. Secondly, I had a comment that I picked up from Tom Isaacs yesterday, who said that he learned somewhere along the way, if you want to have a long-lived career, because it lasts forever, you know, you should pick the nuclear waste business. So Frank, if you're looking for a career for the... We got 40 years at least in front of you to 100 sponsors here. Yeah, right. The other thing is, in our tradition, you always say to anybody at all, at any age that's beyond about 50, you should wish they should live to be 120. You say that when someone's 80 or 85 or 90 or whatever, because no one lives to 120. That was the age that Moses lived to. So it's a blessing that all Jews give to everybody else when they get to any age at all. You should live to be 120, except it's in Yiddish. And so I'll say that to Frank. That means 40 years, because, of course, we all learn, you can read it in the Bible, Moses started his work at age 80, and there was 40 years in the desert, and he died at 120. So you can start at age 80 and have a whole wonderful career that can change the world. Okay? That is, all of you, you can change the world with a 40-year career after you're 80. Okay, I'll go on to my talk. And I'm not going to be 80 for a few years to go. I'm going to talk about the repository. I'm going to talk about regulation. And I'm going to pretend, just for the moment, that you and I, or whoever's thinking this through, is the regulator. So the next slide will then just start with that. I'm just asked the question: how would you go about developing a regulation for a deep geological repository for radioactive waste? And there are some crucial constraints. You're imagining you're the regulator. And I plead guilty to having been in those shoes with Frank, because for 25 years, or almost 30 now, a group of us, there are perhaps 5 or 10 in the room and another 20 out there that aren't in the room, have been thinking about this problem and advising the people that actually write the regulations. And by the way, I was inside NRC, as was John Ahern, when we were writing Part 160. Part 60, the first one, and advising EPA about Part 191. Been there for a long time. There's some crucial constraints about how you think about this regulation, and it tells you what they are there. The performance has to be a very, very long time. And the repository, of course, has to perform passively. That is, after you close it up, it has millennia in which it has to be a passive, no moving parts performance. And crucially, there's no opportunity for imposing learning from operational experience. There's experience putting the waste in. We're going to watch it for 100 years. But there's not, over the time frame of interest, there's no way to get learning millennia hence and feed it back. It's just supposed to be passive. In fact, that's the whole idea. And of course, the public is worried, appropriately, about very long-term releases and exposures. It's the sort of thing that we worry about, so we're trying to do. So I want to insist, and we all know this, but you have to keep insisting that analysis is the only tool. You must do analysis. There's no other way to understand what's going to happen. And thinking about it that way forces you into a different way of thinking about setting up regulations in which the analysis and how it's done and what the figures of merit are is the center. It's not just the center. It's the only thing you've got. Next slide, please. So when you think about the character of the regulations, and as I said, the obvious concern is the long-term exposures to radioactivity, and a regulatory regime has to cope with this, well, there are two fundamental things that you have to worry about. There's a lot more I'm going to come to next. But the first is, you have to. There's a certain dose level that you don't want to have exceeded in the population that you're worried about. And there has to be a certain time period, be it 100 years or a million years. And crucially, and this is a paradigm that's very important, some regulations have placed limits on individual doses. That's the Yucca Mountain standard we've got, individual dose to somebody living nearby. Others have limited the integrated population dose. That's the regulation that governs WIP now. And I'm going to say in a minute that both of those are legitimate. They're both entirely legitimate ways of going about it, but they are very different in the paradigm of the way it's set up, and they're very different in the way the analysis is done and how you interpret it and what uncertainty means and so on. Next slide. And as I said, the regulator's task is not only a simple one, it's very complicated. You know, the crucial question for any regulation is how is compliance to be demonstrated? I said it has to be by analysis, but is it a comparison with a single number? WIP actually has a couple of numbers. You remember a number and then another factor 10 and a different number. The question of how much confidence, that has to do with the compliance. Is it with very, very high confidence, which is what NRC seeks, and I guess the public believe to be appropriate. But there's the question of how you then analyze and express the confidence and how you capture the lack of confidence that's left in your uncertainty. There's always remaining uncertainty. And what do you do with that and how you explain it and how decision makers deal with it? Over what time period? I'm going to talk about that. What's the dose level? Or the collective dose level for WIP? And then to ask who are the receptors of this dose? Well, we assume they're people. Everybody always assumes they're people just like us, that drink water like us and they eat carrots or whatever. And they're adults. Or perhaps you might say, well, why aren't they the most sensitive of our people, infants? What sort of behavior? What group are they? Where do they live? Those decisions have to be made before you get started with the analysis and the regulation, because you can't predict who those people are going to be near Yucca Mountain or near WIP a millennium from now, never minding 10 of them. So the regulation has to stipulate that for the purposes of the compliance demonstration. There's no other way. You could, of course, ask the applicant to tell the regulator what the applicant thought about that, and then there could be an adjudication about that. That's possible, but it seems dumb, and so, of course, the notion that it seems dumb seems to have prevailed, and so the scheme has always been that the regulator is going to specify that for the purposes of analysis. And as a regulator, you've got to do that. You've got to say how many liters of water they drink and what food they're eating and so on. Otherwise, you can't do the calculation, can't work out the doses. You can work out the exposures. But you can't even work out the exposures unless you know how much water they're drinking and where they're getting that water and which food they're eating. Is it local food or is it today? By the way, I buy food at Safeway, and even though California is the breadbasket of the country, and we're in Berkeley, our food isn't mostly local. You want to force and assume that? There are these decisions you have to make, and those decisions then drive the number, the number that is compared with this other number to see whether you flunk or pass. And there aren't factors of 100 here, but there are surely factors of 2 and 3 and 4 that are arbitrary, that there's no way to get around, and so you just have to make a judgment, proceed, and keep going. And that's why the regulator's task is not a simple one, because it's controversial, but in the end, as we've had with these regulations, you settle on it and keep going. Next slide, please. Now, I said before there are two different approaches to doing this in U.S. regulations, and I'm going to describe the first one. This is EPA's Part 191, which still governs the WIP facility, but is no longer operative for Yucca Mountain. And here, the limit is placed on integrated releases of curies over 10,000 years. A box is drawn around the repository, and if a curie escapes that box, it's counted. And you add them up over 10,000 years doing this analysis, and if the curies exceed what's in the table that's in the back of the standard, you flunk. The curies in the table then are tied to some doses through another calculation that you have to do that in the case of the WIP repository was a generic American river and a generic, when it was set, they didn't know whether it was supposed to apply to all the different sites. And so it's really quite generic and hence very arbitrary, not site-specific to WIP at all. But it is what it is, and if you flunk those limits, you don't get a license, and if you pass, and those limits are then tied to a collective dose, meaning persons times REMS, over the 10,000 years. And this is an intrinsically probabilistic analysis in the regulation, and actually by logic, thank God, as Garrick would say, and I think too. It's just wonderful that it's intrinsically probabilistic. And it seems to work okay, and I would endorse it, except that it has to be site-specific. And by the way, the regulation at WIP is not site-specific in terms of how the doses are worked out, so that's nuts. But that's what you'd do if you did it right. And then there's the other issue of human intrusion. You see, there is the worry that someone would come by and inadvertently intrude into any repository and compromise it. The WIP regulation has a kind of, I think, consider, and I'll say later, a crazy way of approaching this. It uses today's exploratory drilling rates. It performs an analysis of drilling and then the releases, and that analysis is technical, science at least. But then it adds them up and adds them probabilistically to the total. And that's nuts. And I'll explain why when I come to the next to the slide about human intrusion. And the reason that it's nuts is because how can we predict who's going to be drilling what in 100 years, never minding in 1,000 or in 10,000, what the technology is, and certainly the rate, which the rate itself of drilling near at WIP goes straight into the probabilistic analysis. And of course, at WIP, it's the only dose. Now, as I said, the original NRC regulation, Part 60, tracked EPA's. It was actually written before. The order was backwards. I was at NRC when we were developing Part 60 in the late 70s. But it also included what we call subsystem requirements, limits on groundwater travel time and a canister leak rate and so on. And those have gone by the board. Cochrane complained about that yesterday, and I'm going to talk about that a little later. And that was in the name of defense in depth. It turns out that although that looks sensible generically, it doesn't apply to some specific sites, in particular the Yucca Mountain site. It doesn't apply the ones they came up with generically, because the system doesn't work that way. It works well, but in a different way than that. And so unless you tailor those subsystem requirements to the site you've got and the engineering and so on, it's illogical to use them because they can constrain a perfectly good thing because it's generic rather than specific. So let me go on to the next slide, and now I'm going to talk about a completely different scheme that is now used in Part 197 of EPA and NRC's Part 63. It governs Yucca Mountain. It's completely different. Remember, before it was an integrated release standard for WIP. This is an individual annual dose to an individual living near the repository. In any one year, over the next 10,000 years, soon to be a million, in any one year, if the dose is exceeded, then you flunk. And it's, again, intrinsically probabilistic. You use the mean dose. That's the figure of merit. And that regulation can also work. It's logical. It makes sense. Except, of course, you've got to define that person and what he or she drinks. That's, of course, quite arbitrary. And it's as different as it can be in formulation at the highest level than the integrated release standard, because it's individual dose rather than collective. But it can work, too. And at the bottom, I conclude that the individual dose approach is preferable, but it's not, to me, at least personally, overwhelmingly so, even though I was a signatory to the TIMS report that recommended using individual dose for Yucca Mountain. The other thing has a lot of merit, especially since all these doses are pretty small. But it would need to be site-specific, which is not true for Part 191. Now let's talk about human intrusion. Here, for Yucca Mountain, the human intrusion standard is very different. You do a stylized analysis of a single inadvertent intrusion using today's technology. That's in there, because you don't know what else to use. But it has a different, and I think a better rationale. And I'm going to come to that in a slide later, but might as well say it here. And that is, to me, what the issue of human intrusion is imagine that an intruder could come by and do something that would permanently and irrevocably damage the containment capability. I want to know that. That's a bad situation. Not necessarily a bad site, a bad combination of site and engineering. If the combination of site and engineering you have is such that one intruder or a couple of them can come in and inadvertently and they just poke, and the thing doesn't work anymore, like poking a two-inch hole in a PWR pressure vessel, which can't be fixed, I want to know that. And to me, that's the purpose of an intrusion analysis. This other idea of figuring out that there's 42 over a century rather than 21, and therefore you get twice the dose, like the WIP reg is crazy. Okay. So I think that intrusion regulation, which is in the Part 197, which came out of the TIMS report, which was written by Chris Whipple and Susan Wilshire and me. We were the subcommittee, and Chris is sitting in front of me, and I'm proud of that. It was one of the nice things. We were the subcommittee that thought that through and convinced everybody else of its efficacy, is exactly right. Next slide. Now, and here I speak about intrusion. This is the... Right. And that's what I said. I conclude that the only genuine benefit of a human intrusion part of the regulations is to rule out a scheme if you can poke a hole in it. If there's a poke a hole flaw. And I said that. Next slide, thanks. So now I'm going to talk about the time frame, and this is a really important issue because the question of the period for which protection is to be shown in the regulatory analysis is a vital, crucial piece of it. And I'm going to talk for a minute of my recollection of why 10,000 years was selected at the time. This is EPA's reasoning in 1983. When they wrote 191, one of the things that EPA was thinking about at the time was they were going to use this regulation to discriminate between a whole bunch of sites to pick the best or at least the better of these sites and discriminate against the lousy ones. And EPA said, Dan Egan said, in fact at the higher levels they said, that 1,000 years was judged way too short because any site would be acceptable with some decent engineering. Okay? The idea is, well, you put it on the White House lawn. But of course, that's false about the White House lawn because you need the underground environment to create the chemical and physical and water regime under which the rest of it works. So the White House lawn thing is spurious, but that was the argument. You do a bunch of engineering, anybody knows how to build a can that'll last 1,000 years, and so 1,000 years wasn't judged to be enough. And the standard mantra was, and of course you shouldn't ever be able to use engineering to fix a bad site, even though I'm going to tell you that my view is that it's not a bad site or bad engineering, if the combination works, it works. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And you've got to analyze it as a system. Now, 100,000 years was judged too long because at the time, the EPA people thought that the analysis methods couldn't support it. We now know they can, except for glaciation, which I'm going to tell you makes it nuts. That's later. But that was the judgment, and so 10,000 was in between 1,000 and 100,000, and they picked it on that basis. And they also had the cockeyed idea at first that it was about the time when the repository risk approaches the risk from the original uranium ore. Well, that kind of makes sense, right? Except if you look at the 7 or 8 ore bodies from which our ore was coming in 1980s, that made the fuel, their risks had about a 6 or 7 order of magnitude range between the ones that were more tighter and the ones that were looser. And so you didn't know what ore you were dealing with. So that didn't make any sense, and that was thrown out. And they ended up with 10,000 on the basis that it would, of the site selection basis, okay? That's exactly where 10,000 came from in my recollection. Now I want to comment about something that Frank's sitting in front of me and we'll chuckle about, and that is that in 1982 maybe, the EPA put together a panel of their science advisory board. Frank was a member and so was I. To advise EPA about, at the time, the draft standard 191. And they asked us the question, or at least we asked ourselves the question, about what this period of performance would be. And we sat around, I remember Dave Okrent sitting there, for example, and tried to figure out our grandchildren, whether it mattered to our grandchildren's grandchildren, and so on. And we ended up pretty strongly voting with only one or two dissensions out of a committee of a dozen or more, that we kind of thought 500 years was right. And then we rounded it up to 1,000. And Frank is nodding. You remember that? Some people even thought 300. And 10,000 just seemed like it was unnecessary, because if you do some arithmetic, every single human on the planet is going to be descended from me, if I have any kids at all, who have kids of their own by then, because of the mixing. It's just, you know, 2 to the 2 to the 2, and you work it out. And we concluded that a key concern that people had was for people in their own community, or people that they knew, or people who were like them, and that's all mixed up by 1,000 years, or even by many hundred. And that was our logic, and we recommended it, and they rejected it. I even remember a very strong dissension from a member of the Science Advisory Board, I'm trying to remember who, Roger McClellan, who wrote us back and said, we didn't ask you to do risk management, we asked, but even in fact they had asked us to recommend risk management issues. And anyway, it didn't go anywhere, but that was our logic at the time. And I'm going to tell you in a couple slides from now that that's where I've come out to, although a little longer. Now, next slide has to do with 1 million years. The reasoning in the last few years about 1 million years goes as follows. The notion is that the dose at Yucca Mountain in the calculations is still rising at 10,000 years. Why would you cut it off? And we said in the Tim's report, John Ahern, Art Upton's here, Chris Wimble's here, we said that there's no technical reason to pick 10,000 years, because there isn't any technical reason to pick anything else, except there is a technical rationale for a peak dose somewhere. And that's what we said. But then we said it's a policy, not a technical call, and it remains so, and the court just screwed it up. And I'm not going to argue about that. The peak dose actually comes out. But I'm going to say something that I think may seem odd to you, but I think is a very profound observation. The fact that the peak dose comes at 400,000 years from now is because the engineering is so good. It's so good that nothing gets out in the first 10,000. I think that's a triumph. You want us to water it down so the peak dose comes at 6,000 years? Huh? Even though the site's wonderful too, by the way, read the EIS, it's out there. The doses even way out there are really low. But we can make the peak dose earlier. Just water down that can. I think that's stupid decision making. So the fact that peak dose comes all the way out there is a wonderful attribute, especially since they're low. And now I'm going to tell you, yet that's where they came out on using the Academy's thing the wrong way and misunderstanding it. And I just think it's nuts. So go to the next slide and I'm going to explain why. What's wrong with this reasoning? Well, first off, the idea about using engineering to fix a poor site misses the point, as I said. Any repository worth its salt has to use engineering and the site together to make a sound system. And if the system works and is demonstrably safe with lots of margin, I don't particularly care whether it's got more this and less that, or more that and less this, as Chris was saying about belt and suspenders. It seems to me you analyze it as it sits, and if it's great, it's great. And, of course, you use some engineering. And as I said, if you've got a wonderful site, you still don't want to say it's a wonderful site. You don't do any. There's no engineering at WIT, by the way. But at Yucca Mountain, we got this wonderful engineering, too. It turns out now we think it's more necessary than they thought at first, but it works together. So I think that's nuts. And the White House lawn argument breaks down anyway, because we need the underground to create the chemical and thermal and physical environment in which the engineering works so well. Never minding, we need the underground because of all of its other attributes, including what happens afterwards. And as I said, number three, I said this 3 minutes ago, the fact that the peak dose occurs well after 10,000 years is a result of good engineering and of a good design, and it's a triumph. It's not a flaw. It's a triumph. And I'm proud to have been part of a project that came out doing that well, even though I didn't contribute to that part of it at all. And I'm going to tell you, we have an even better waste package in the wings that in 10 years is going to end up being used. It's going to be an amorphous metal rather than that can, and it's going to be so much better, although it still has some work before we're ready to spring it on the world. And it began its work under the Science Technology Program that I was there with Mark Peters putting together 5 years ago in Yucca Mountain, and it's coming along in another decade, and it's going to be so much better. It's going to be better engineering, and it's going to be cheaper, and it's going to be more demonstrable. Do you want us not to do that? And then finally, this is the ice age. And that's why I think it's nuts. Spending large resources today, changing, you know, it's several billion, several tens of billion. You want to spend a bunch of billion on this? I don't. To protect against tiny doses way out there ignores a lot of other future societal impacts, like the ice age. I want to tell you something. Every climatologist I know, everyone, even with global warming, predicts that sometime in the next few hundred thousand years, and probably in the next 100,000. In fact, a lot of them say in the next 10 or 20,000. There's going to be an ice age. The entire of Canada has disappeared. The whole of Northern America, the U.S., has disappeared. New York is under 100 meters of ice. So is Cleveland. So is Chicago. Nobody in the United States is spending a penny to think about, never mind to mitigate that. And if anybody suggested spending $100 or $100 million to mitigate that, they'd be considered nuts. No politician would be able to survive with that as something they want to do. And yet, apparently, Yucca Mountain won't be able to get a license if it's got this many milligrams instead of this many at that time. That's crazy. Bob Budnitz is telling you it's crazy. As I said, who cares? Who cares about milliremes in Nevada when the half of the U.S. is under a glacier? And who would recommend to spend money now to mitigate it? We're having trouble spending money now to mitigate something that's going to happen in the next 50 and 100 years called CO2. So the million, you kidding? Next slide. So here's where I come out. Oh, well, first I'm going to talk about why 1,000 years. Well, 1,000 years is actually more in line with the way society protects against other toxic things. There's nothing else we protect against that's more than 1,000 years, and some of them, as you heard, the Ricker and Tosca, they're 30 and 50. Much longer protection for these things, whose dose is actually quite small, could be judged a huge misallocation when you think about it. Now, the argument against 1,000 years is that requiring 10,000 years is easy to meet, and that turns out to be the case, but it may not be. As I said, it's true, but it's costly. It's true, but it may be forcing a dumb design, or at least an inefficient design, and it may not even be true. Okay? And, of course, the counterargument is, well, the fact that they mismanaged toxic chemicals is no excuse. Let's get it right this time. And there's a rationale of that, and I'm in touch with that. So next slide, and I'm going to tell you where I come out about the bottom line. I conclude that going to 1 million years is nuts, for the reasons I said. It's just absolutely insane. To invest resources, or to have the repository flunk, because it can't meet some dose at 500 or 300,000 years from now. A dose that, by the way, is in any event very small. By the way, if they were 100 gram, okay, I don't want that. But they're not. Using 10,000 is okay. This is with me. It's Bob Budnitz. But it's unnecessary. And I'd prefer a few thousand years if I was writing them today. The few thousand years, because we have confidence that over the next few thousand years there's not going to be a glacier. And beyond that, it doesn't change very much between 3,000 and 10,000, by the way, or 20. But I would say you do it to where you kind of think the glacier comes in and forget it. And since we don't know when that is, either the regulator has to tell us for the purpose of analysis where it is, or you make some judgment that all the climatologists think is on the lower medium side of it, and then you stop it there. And going beyond that has no protection value. It's a waste of our resources, and it certainly is a smokescreen to tell the public that you're protecting, because you're not. It just simply isn't the case, because everything is going to change. So that's where I come out, and I know it's normative and controversial, and I don't mind it. Next slide, and I'm going to talk about the level of protection. And here, the level of protection means how many milligram or collective dose, and so on. Now, I said here, and I kind of think that this is where Bob Budnitz comes out, I think that the dose from the repository should be lower than society cares about. That is smaller than variations in natural background. And to me, here's how I come out. We live in Berkeley. Once we contemplated moving to Denver, but we didn't. I don't remember anybody who ever thought they wouldn't move to Denver because of the doses. Anybody here know anybody like that? Okay? The public don't care about 100, 200 extra millirem every year. And I kind of think the standard ought to be lower than any detectable harmful effects. And it ought to be in a range where the biologists are truly uncertain. I mean, Art Upton is here. There's a community of people, his colleagues. They're truly uncertain about whether these harmful effects actually exist. So I'm real happy with where we are, except for something that's kind of odd. The standard that, the one that was remanded in the late 90s, sat around for a couple of years while EPA and NRC had a contest. I don't mind saying a pissing contest, about whether it was going to be 25 or 15. Who remembers that? Well, 25, 15. 25, 15. Less fattening, right? You remember? Now, okay. But since there's so much arbitrariness in the rest of it, I told you about way, way more than factors of two. I mean, come on, boys and girls. But that's what happened. Either of those is fine with me. It meets my criteria. It's, society doesn't care about it. And we can meet it. That's really important. If we couldn't meet it, we'd find something else. Because frankly, 50 doesn't bother me either. 75 doesn't bother me. Because I would move to Denver in a heartbeat if it was mattered to my life. Okay? And the rest of it seems like pretty obvious. So I come out pretty strongly saying, in that range, it's fine with me. Next slide, other regulatory issues. And I'm almost done here. Well, I mentioned human intrusion before. Except there's this kind of funny thing. An intruder using today's technology, it's the only thing it's in the regulations, it's in WIP regulations, it's in the NRC's regulations. Well, what else would you use, of course? But in fact, almost anything you use ought to meet the sensible test. You're testing whether the poke the whole scenario is actually going to compromise it or not. And if you're going to test that, I don't care what technology you use to poke the hole. A stylized scenario has to be. But adding the dose to that from the other natural processes, that's nuts. And yet that's what governs WIP. That's what's in 191. It's crazy. Next, relying on institutional control. No, go back. I didn't mean next slide, next issue. The regulations assume that no memory occurs after a century. And that was because we were really uncomfortable about 1,000 years. Even though, by the way, 1,000 years seems, you know, I visit 1,000-year-old buildings all the time. I actually have a relative that lives in a 1,000-year-old building, or a 700-year-old building, and we know people like that in London, or 500 maybe, whatever it is. But I'm not sure. But the point is, we all know that 1,000-year buildings that haven't been cared for well have been looked after. So why did we assume 100 rather than 1,000 years for assume institutional control is forgotten about? And why not after? Why not after 1,000? 10,000 seems excessive to me. But if the regulation said institutional control was retained for hundreds of years or 1,000 or so, I'd be completely comfortable with that. This is just Bob Budden telling you what my normative view is. I'm not uncomfortable with 100. It doesn't affect much. Although it looks a little extreme to think that we would completely forget about everything about Yucca Mountain within the lifetime of, more or less the lifetime of teeny tiny grandchildren now. That seems a little pushy to me, and I'm not going to argue about it except just to comment that if I was doing this over, that looks a little short. Next slide, please. Retrievability. The crucial societal issue about uncertainty is embedded in the retrievability requirement. That is, I can tell anybody who's skeptical with a straight face that the requirement is it's going to stay open for 100 years, during which time our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren are going to figure out whether or not this is a good idea. Whether there's a flaw in the design, or a use for the waste, we all know what that is, use for the plutonium, or an innovative concept might come along in which it's cheaper and better, any of those. So it's going to be open for 100 years. That seems a terrific idea to me. We're not going to argue about whether it's 50 or 150, but something like that. And by the way, 100 years, but if our grandchildren in 50 years decide to hell with this 100-year thing, they can do that. That's their prerogative. We'll be dead. But that sort of thing, designing it so that that's true, seems to me a rational public policy, and I endorse it, and I'm thrilled with it. Next slide, please. Now, here's something that John Garrick said, which I endorse in my bones. And that is, it's the second point here, so I'll say it first. And that is, we have to do analysis for compliance. It's the only thing to demonstrate and achieve compliance. But we also have to understand the repository separately from the compliance calculation, because only through understanding will we understand whether even the regulations and the compliance thing taken together make sense. And crucially, by an understanding analysis, we can improve things or find out where the flaws are. Even if it meets the regulation, there will be flaws, and you'll find them. That's what we learn with PRA. That's what a realistic calculation does. But, of course, the realistic calculation has to be careful about how it deals with uncertainties so as to capture them all, so the decision makers can make their decisions in the face of the real uncertainties that are in front of the analyst, all of them, even though trying to figure out how to combine them to get a number is always controversial. But expressing them and writing them down and having people chew on them and stare at them and figure out what they would do in the face of them seems to me a vital thing that we have to do. And what John called for, you know, earlier before the break, is exactly right about that. Now, of course, it's related to the compliance using conservative requirements or realistic analysis that I mentioned above. I'm thrilled with a risk-based performance approach. I just say that in my bones. I could imagine subsystem performance requirements at Yucca Mountain tailored to Yucca Mountain. I could think of a couple, but they'd be easy to meet. And if they give more assurance, I wouldn't be deeply troubled by that. But the ones that were written down in Part 60 are nuts because they don't fit Yucca Mountain. You don't need 10 to the minus 5 canister performance, and you don't need 1,000-year travel time and the demonstration robustly of that to show that the system works as it works. Such seems erroneous. What Tom Cochran called for yesterday seems erroneous to me. He said, let's make sure that the can will work by itself, and then let's throw the can away and make sure that the geology works by itself. I don't see that. Because unlike a reactor, this thing isn't a can by itself, and it isn't the Earth by itself. It's a system that we designed to optimize. And to me, how you capture that is with risk-based, not risk-informed, risk-based regulations and realistic analysis on top of it. Taken together, that's where I want to be. Next slide, costs. I'm almost done. This is my last one. The argument about the cost of the repository and the cost of regulation is misleading, and I'm going to tell you why. You see, I see the Yucca Mountain repository as a relatively inexpensive solution. It's $50 to $100 billion. But it, in the end, represents less than 2% of the value of electricity generated. Less than 2% of the value of electricity generated. No other technology to make electricity or do anything else can dispose of the most important of its nasty wastes for as low as less than 2% of the value of what it produced. That's not true of the semiconductor industry, and it sure as hell ain't true for coal, which is the direct competitor. So it's cheap, even though it's billions. So I said true, and what I just said. But, of course, tens of billions is still real money. You remember Eric Dirksen? Being here, being there? So I still want to say it's still billions, and let's try to optimize it. Being here, being there is still real money. So I want to optimize it. Now, some people say, well, let's not, you know, the argument, what else could you do with these resources if we saved it? Because it's in the waste fund. And the other argument is, well, you know, the dollars wouldn't be made available to anybody else, so let's use it. And I don't subscribe to that. If we can save it, let's save it. We can actually do intelligent things that can save money and make safety better and make operations easier. You just have to do an integrated design and an integrated analysis and think about the whole thing together. And which is what Garrick said, and which I reaffirm. So when I think about the cost, one, we should try to save as many billions as we can. But two, it ain't much money. It's less than 2% of the value of electricity, and it just ain't much money. Last slide, and this is my wrap up. And the first bullet says exactly what I've been saying 8 ways, but I'll say it just in one way. There's a lot of arbitrariness in any set of regulations governing such a repository. Arbitrariness. Here, there, there's 9 places where it's arbitrary, which means the number you get in the regulations, 15 milligram? I mean, come on. You could just say the people drank more water and get a different number. They ate less carrots, get a different number. It's 10 kilometers, not 18, get a different number. You know, from the site boundary, it's right on top, you get a different number. There's so much arbitrariness that arguing about that stuff, room for policy-based judgment, that's baloney. I mean, by the way, it's not a bad thing that there's arbitrariness in there. That's what we do with judgment. But in the end, you settle on it and you move forward. Provided the regulations are not so restrictive as to impede progress. It'd be terrible if we had regulations that prohibited geologic disposal entirely. I could imagine such, by the way. I could write one. That'd be terrible to me. And of course, provided that they protect it against what the public wants to be protected against, which is that large doses will not ensue in the foreseeable future to nearby populations. That's what the public correctly want the repository program to achieve. And that's what we write the regulations to achieve, and that's what we're reviewing the thing to make sure that we achieve. And the rest of this arbitrariness is just an artifact of the fact that in a legal system, we have to have legal things with which we do tests and challenges in order to come out with the answer that enables a sensible thing to proceed without sloppiness and without a lot of waste. And with that, I'll leave you just with a notion that when I quoted the 300 or 500 year thing, and Frank was nodding, I still, although I think a few thousand years would be where I came out, and I said so, I wouldn't be at all unhappy with somebody that ended up with 1,000 years or less, because we're not protecting against the toxic stuff that goes in the San Francisco Bay right now. I put stuff in my garbage, it goes in the bay, and it's going to be out of there in 100 years, and it's way worse than this, okay? So in the end, although I said a few thousand, I'm not so worried about this. No matter what I do, these impacts are not important. John Garrick said it most eloquently. The real risk is a nuclear bomb on New York. The real risks are obesity. The real risks are toxic things in our environment with which we're not coping at all. The real risks are CO2. This is just chicken feed. Thank you very much.